revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a special show, one I'm looking forward to. We speak a lot about the health of us as human beings, but those of us who have family members who happen to be pets want them to be as healthy as we are. And I wanted to take a little detour because it's something that we don't talk about, but I think it's becoming, I guess, forefront of what our healthcare system, especially for our pets, needs to be. So we're going to speak with Dr. Judy and Dr. Judy Jasek. She received her formal education at Colorado State University, including a bachelor's degree in zoology. She followed that with her doctorate degree of veterinary medicine in 1988. She remained in the Western United States, practicing in Idaho, Utah, and returned to Colorado in 2001, where she owned and operated an integrative medicine practice for 12 years. She then developed more specialized practice, emphasizing the terrain approach to healing. Her foundational belief is that health is the natural state of the body. We do not create health, we support the body's natural ability to attain it. She believes that true healing must encompass not only the physical body, but also includes the mental, emotional, and environmental aspects of the pet's terrain. Her treatment protocols emphasize the importance of species-appropriate nutrition, augmented by natural healing aids, including herbs, homeopathy, ozone, and mistletoe. She also highly recommends the use of hands-on modalities, such as acupuncture, chiropractic, and massage. She's currently working to develop an educational platform to help other veterinarians learn and practice this method of true healing to regain the love of practice. And you're speaking as a allopathic doctor, you're speaking my language, because I think our healthcare system has become so medication driven, so artificial. And I think the pets are doing the treatment of the pets are the same as the humans. And are you finding that pets are getting sicker, even though there's so many medications and treatments out there that it's not, I mean, for the humans, I think we're taking more medicines and it's not working for us. What's your take?
Oh, absolutely. Like 1,000%. I think that's why I'm so driven, you know, to promote this whole idea that we need to be treating our pets differently because they are getting sicker. One of my specialties is I work with a lot of pets with cancer, providing alternative modalities, for people that don't want to do the traditional surgery, chemo, radiation route. And what I'm finding is that pets are getting cancer at younger and younger ages. Like I've seen dogs as young as 18 months diagnosed with like an aggressive lymphoma. And that's just really tragic. And it didn't used to be that way. You know, early in my career, when I first graduated, I was in a conventional practice. You know, I started out doing like I was taught. I evolved into this way of practicing. But we didn't, even back then, we were vaccinating and I didn't know as much about nutrition as I do now. But cancer was an old age disease back then. You know, it was something dogs died from. We didn't see dogs 2 and 3 years old being diagnosed with cancer. So yeah, clearly we're going the wrong direction in veterinary medicine.
Now that's tragic to have basically a puppy pretty much get diagnosed with these catastrophic diseases. Do you see any correlation between environment and what's happening with the pets? Like, you know, we have microplastics, we have all these things in our food supply and our water supply, and our pets are the front line. Are any of these things, do you think, contributing to this?
Oh yeah. I think disease fundamentally is toxicity. Because as you know, you read in my bio, my foundational philosophy is that health is the natural state of the body. We don't create health. That's the whole, I think, misnomer of how medicine and health is approached. Like you get the new pet, the puppy or the kitten, and what did you got to run them into the vet to get, you know, shots and all this stuff. So you're running them in and start poisoning them. Like we need to change that whole paradigm and that whole way of thinking to health is natural. We don't create it. God created our bodies perfect, created our animals' bodies perfect. We don't need to give them a bunch of pharmaceuticals to create that. So I believe fundamentally that diseases, all disease that shows up is probably a combination of toxicity and nutritional deficiency. So they're not getting the diet that their body needs to stay healthy. So does, back to your question, does environment matter? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we need to be giving our pets filtered water so they're not getting chlorine and fluoride and all the pharmaceuticals that can be present in city water. We need to be cognizant of where their food is sourced, and they're going to be susceptible to EMFs and chemtrails, and they need to get out and get their feet on the ground. You know, you hear so much talk, I hear a lot of talk about, you know, grounding, how important it is for us to get out in the sun and put our feet on the earth. Well, you might think, well, pets just naturally do that, but what about an indoor cat? Or what about a dog that lives in, you know, we're living in rural Tennessee now, but we were in a Denver suburb and watched these dogs walk back and, you know, up and down our street. They're on concrete and the pavement. You know, how much are their feet even touching the earth? Glyphosate, all the pesticides and herbicides. So I think that all contributes. And I think those environmental chemicals like pesticides and herbicides are huge because dogs got their noses right down there. They're sniffing it in. They get it on their paws and they come in and they lick it off. So they're directly ingesting it. But I think one of the biggest things that's happening that's also paralleling human medicine is the vaccines. And they have become so much more toxic because, like you said, you have a 1 or 2 year old dog diagnosed with cancer. They're babies, they're teenagers. They could be eating shoe leather and they may not be optimally healthy, but they're not going to die from cancer. But what do young dogs get? They get all these vaccines, and with the the corporate takeover of veterinary medicine, as I believe the same thing has happened in human medicine, where these big private equity companies are just buying up all the clinics, there's fewer and fewer independently owned clinics, and they're just all profit driven. So instead of giving like a couple rounds of vaccines to a puppy, they're wanting to do 4, 5, and 6 rounds of boosters. So these poor pets are being hammered with the vaccines, and there's just no doubt in my mind that they're more toxic. I don't know what they're putting in these things, but they are devastating. And they advertise the mRNA technology, they meaning the pharmaceutical companies. I'm going to get the ads because I'm a vet, right? I'm on mm-hmm. the list. And so all this new technology, and gee, you know, this all started coming out around COVID for people, and what's happened to human health since these mRNA vaccines started being used. And I mean, they're not testing this stuff. They don't test the human vaccines. Do you think they're testing this stuff before they put it in vials and the pharmaceutical rep goes and sells it to the to the veterinarian? I mean, they're not testing them at all. And the vets don't read the warning labels. You know, I would encourage, you know, if people want to know, you know, what can I do? What can I do to help my pet? Next time you're at the vet and they recommend a vaccine or a pharmaceutical, ask them to pull out that package insert and say, I'd like to sit down and go over this. And I want to read what the potential adverse effects are, because you should be getting at the very least informed consent, where they are going over the pros and cons of every treatment with you. And that's not happening. And in my opinion, that's highly incompetent.
You know, you're speaking to my heart on this, because I absolutely agree with you. And it's the same way in human healthcare as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of, I didn't know that there were, I know for pediatrics, there's this, you know, list of vaccines that the children need to get. Is that the same thing with pets?
It's a little bit looser, I think, in pets. I mean, obviously not a pediatrician, but what I've heard is there's a very kind of set schedule for children. In pets, they have what they call core vaccines and kind of lifestyle vaccines. So the core vaccines would be things like in puppies, parvo and distemper, I think hepatitis might be on there. There's a hepatitis vaccine. Rabies is on there. For cats, it's feline distemper is on there. And then there's these respiratory viruses, you know, supposedly that cats can get. And then, of course, rabies. So there's core vaccines that are recommended. And then the others are supposed to be based on lifestyle, meaning are they going to be exposed to the diseases? Like there's diseases in dogs vaccines for diseases like influenza and kennel cough, which is a Bordetella cough that dogs can get. And so, if you have an indoor dog that never goes to a boarding kennel, little, 3-pound Yorkie or something, never leaves the house, well, they're not likely to be exposed. So they shouldn't be getting those vaccines. But, fear is just fear and guilt are the two most powerful emotions. And when it comes to selling, probably just about anything, but it certainly holds true for pets. And all the veterinarian has to do is say, well, there's a chance that your dog could, get, some disease from the squirrel that's running around in your backyard, and people get afraid, and they're going to feel guilty if they don't do it and their pet gets sick. And I think personally, all this vaccine business, I'm in the camp anymore that I think a lot of the virus narrative has been made up to make people afraid of viruses, because that's what sells vaccines. And I've become of the opinion that if we're being told to do something, or it's recommended that we tell our clients to do something or suggest that they do something based on fear, that it's most likely for profit and not for health, because you don't create health out of being afraid of something. You create health by supporting the body and loving the body and giving the body what it needs. If you're doing things out of fear or guilt, then you have to really take a step back and take a deep breath and rethink your decision.
I think I would add one more to it, that education. It should be about educating your patient.
Yes.
Got nothing to hide. Then let it all hang out and let the patient make a decision on what's best for them.
And right.
I can't begin to describe how much I agree with you on informed consent. That was the bedrock of healthcare,
yes,
20 years ago. And now it doesn't exist.
Right.
Remember during the whole epidemic that there was no insert. It was blank.
Right.
Ultimately, how on earth can you counsel somebody when you don't even know what the side effects are? That's unacceptable.
And how can the doctors give it? How can they? I mean, they don't probably, I'm sure most vets don't take the time to read package inserts. But if there's nothing there, how can you in good conscience give something that you know is experimental that, and you don't even know what's in it? And you're just, trusting the government? Like, yeah, because they're looking out for our best interest, right? Like, it's insane what doctors and veterinarians have given themselves permission to do. And if you read, and anybody that's listening, I don't know what states your listeners are in, but you can look up online the veterinary practice code for your state. You just Google it, something along the veterinary state board or the practice code or something along those lines, and it will come up the actual requirements for veterinary, the parameters for veterinary practice. And everyone I've ever read says they should be giving informed consent. It says right in the practice code, it's part of the terms of their license that they are to be discussing all the pros and cons of every treatment option with their clients. Yet many clinics now, they require a rabies vaccine to walk in the door. Yet even the manufacturer, the people selling the vaccine, says right on their insert should only be given to healthy animals. And the vets are even ignoring that. They're just, nope, they're just requiring those vaccines to even walk in the door. So they're going against the vaccine manufacturers and against their own practice code. They should be being sued for malpractice for that.
Well, it's about knowledge. If the pet parent doesn't know this, they don't know.
I know. Stand. That's why I love doing things like this, so I can open people's eyes. Because vets tell people these days, because I hear these stories from my clients all the time. They say, well, if I don't require you to get your pet a rabies shot, I'll lose my license. And that's a lie. That's what people are being told. And it's an absolute lie. There's no veterinary code anywhere that requires veterinarians to enforce vaccines. It's between the pet owner and the law. Are there laws? Yeah. But like I've always taken the approach, somebody comes in, I talk to them about rabies. Yes, there's these rules. If you choose not to do a rabies vaccine and your dog goes bites somebody, there's going to be consequences. But here's the health risks of giving it. And it's just like you're saying, give informed consent. Give them all the pros and cons and all the different sides. And then they decide. And that's what practice should be. And that's true informed consent.
And I absolutely agree. That's where should be the nucleus of healthcare. Mm-hmm. That's where you have the relationship, this honesty between mm-hmm. the practitioner and the patient and the client. If you don't have that and you just have someone using you as a cost center, then that's a problem with that, for sure.
Right.
On that note, let's take our first break and come back. You're Living in the Solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Judy Jasek, and you can go to her website, AHA, is it AHA Vet or AHA Vet?
Yeah. AHAVET.com. My practice is Animal Healing Arts is the name, but so it's just the initials.
Before the break, we're doing a really wonderful job of explaining to our listeners this vaccine industry. I have a question, a segue to this. Is it necessary to get these shots every year? I mean, don't they have some sort of longevity to them? I mean, how do they just stop working in a year, like rabies, for example, or distemper?
Yeah, I fundamentally don't think they're necessary at all. I think pets could be perfectly healthy again if we stop being afraid of things out there that are going to attack our pets and focus on keeping their bodies healthy. But that being said, I have done a lot of titer testing. Now, titer testing is where you measure antibodies, that give a vaccine and then you measure the antibodies generated. And there's lots of opinions on what that number actually means. Some will say it's not valid, but I feel like if a number on a piece of paper gets a pet out of getting another vaccine, then I'm all for it. And I have seen where puppies, for example, could get just one set of vaccines, get a titer test done. And if they do them a little bit older, like they're more like 9 or 10 weeks, they're not starting super young, like 5 or 6 weeks, one set of vaccines and do the titer test. And it shows adequate immunity to these puppy diseases like parvo and distemper. And then I've had clients, instead of vaccinating, they will get that blood test done maybe every year or every couple of years. And I've seen it be good for years. Like it doesn't go away. So to your point, no, they don't need to be repeated. There was a immunologist named Ron Schultz. I believe he's retired now. I think he worked out of Purdue, and he was not a veterinarian. He was strictly an immunologist, and he studied immunity and the need for boosters. And he did research on this, and he says there's no immunological justification for doing booster shots. Once the body like mounts an immunity, the cells have memory, and that immunity should be maintained. And so a lot of this stuff's just all made up. I mean, who does the studies that says how often we need to do booster shots? It's the companies making the vaccines. So are they going to tell you just give these once and never give them again? No, because they're selling vaccines. So they're going to want you doing it as often as possible. Almost all rabies vaccines anymore are labeled to be given every 3 years. Yet there's a county just, right here in my area that requires it every year. So they just changed the local laws, even though the manufacturer says that it's good for 3 years.
Whoever said that it's not valid to look at the antibody response is ridiculous. I mean, I've had mumps, measles, chicken pox as a kid. Years later, the titers are still positive and I'm immune. Mm-hmm. That would make perfect sense that if people had a question, they wanted to, use science in their favor for a change, Mm-hmm. They could get the titers tested and say there's no reason, and then get a certificate saying that the pet mm-hmm. is immune. Would that be a good strategy?
Yeah, I think that's a really good, valid option. Now, the issue people will run into is a lot of vets won't run titer tests, or they charge astronomical amounts. Like, I've had people go into their vet and ask for like a titer test for rabies and be quoted something like $1,000 for it. Yeah. And it doesn't cost that much. I used to run them all the time. The other interesting thing, like in particular for the rabies, because the rabies is a real stickler because there's the rules and regulations. So, you know, you could decide, hey, I'm just going to do one round of puppy shots or kitten shots and call it good. But there's these rules, you know, that, you know, could get a little sticky if your pet gets caught without a current rabies shot. So the vets, a lot of vets will say, well, you know, those titer tests, you know, again, they say they're not valid, you know, they don't mean anything. Well, veterinarians, when they're in school, are required to get rabies shots. I actually had to get rabies vaccines when I was in school. It's a liability thing for the vet school. Knowing what I know now, I would have tried to get out of that. But, you know, I was just a young whippersnapper back then. And they instruct the veterinarians that after they're out of school, that every year they should do what? They should get a titer test to see if they need a booster. So they're recommending it. This is the AVMA, so the American Veterinary Medical Association, is recommending this. As a matter of fact, at there they have an annual conference every year. At the conference, they offer like reduced cost blood draws for vets can get their titer test done for rabies to see if they need a booster. So there, it's completely valid for the vets to do it, but doesn't mean anything in the animals. So there's just all this double talk, you know. So you know that we're not hearing the truth. it just doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it's, you know, double standard, to put it mildly, and follow the money, which is my mantra. It seems to mm-hmm. be a truth that goes throughout society. So let's take a different tack now and talk about food, because the commercials on TV were being inundated all of a sudden with fresh food and, you know, not overprocessed. Can you talk a bit about the food industry? Because the obesity level, I'm sure, in pets have gone, like humans, through the mm-hmm. roof. I mean, see these cats who can barely walk. It's tragic, really. Mm-hmm. But is it the food driving some of this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So if you take your average dry food, which is probably the most common thing fed to dogs and cats, your average kibble type food, it's about 50% processed carbohydrate. And it doesn't matter if it's grain-free or not. The grain-free foods have things like lentils and peas and beans and potato and other forms of starch. They're all about 50% starch, which breaks down into sugar in the body, which is A, inflammatory, and B, these are carnivores. Cats, in fact, are obligate carnivores. They get very sick when they're fed sugar. That's basically, they live their life in a state of type 2 diabetes, these really obese cats, because they're not meant to be eating all this essentially sugar, not to mention they're very toxic because a lot of these ingredients are sprayed with glyphosate. The fresh food products, quote unquote, fresh food products that are coming out now that are popular, a lot of times are not that much better nutritionally because they still have a high amount of starch in, which keeps the price down because it's cheaper to feed starches like rice or potato and things like that than to feed a meat-based diet, which is really what dogs and cats are meant to eat. The diet I recommend for dogs and cats is meat, bone, and organ. It's a species appropriate. What would they eat in the wild? If a dog were to be surviving on its own, a bigger dog would go kill a rabbit and a cat would be killing a mouse or a bird and eating it. That's what they're meant to be eating. They're not meant to be eating any starch whatsoever. And in fact, they don't really have the digestive capacity to break down plant cell walls very efficiently. I mean, a little bit of produce, especially for dogs, is okay. I think it can help feed the microbiome a bit. That's why dogs sometimes like go eat grass when they got a upset stomach. A little bit of the fiber and the vegetation can help. I think it's incorrect to be using produce to quote unquote balance the diet, because you can completely balance the diet for a carnivore using meat, bone, and organs. So you have the meat, which is the muscle, meat, and fat. And then the organs are super nutritious. There's lots of nutrients, vitamins and minerals in organs. Needs to be a mix of organs, liver, heart, kidney, lungs, spleen, all of them. And then the bone is the mineral content. And that's how I recommend balancing a diet. I don't recommend putting any synthetic nutrients in ever, because those are just chemicals that come out of a lab and we have no idea if they're even bioavailable. And I've been recommending this type of feeding for, you know, probably 20 years. So, and most conventional vets these days are like, oh, that raw food is horrible. And, you know, they tell people they're killing their pets, feeding it and all that. And it's like, you know, they have no experience feeding it. So they're just repeating propaganda that they've heard. And I've seen it work. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, what I am seeing be effective and turn pets, I mean, I've seen so many pets' health just completely turn around by getting them on a species appropriate diet. That, I mean, like, why would I recommend anything else? And why would I do it if I didn't feel it was in the best interest of my patients? Like, I'm not selling dog food, you know, I'm recommending this because I really feel like it's in the best interest of the health of my patients.
Well, I'm with you with that, with the mindset of the body is self-healing if you get out of the way and give it what it needs, you know, and I read these labels and what is, there's this meal or mixture, I guess they're putting ground up animal bits in it as part of the makeup of some of this food, some of these kibbles, I guess, and some of the wet food. Do you know exactly what does that mean when it says animal meal?
It means it could be anything, like feathers, feet, intestines. And not that all of those things are necessarily bad, but if they're not, you know, processed properly, and you have to think about what you're getting. So if they're saying, well, it's, you know, got X amount of animal products in it, but that's just ground up beaks and feathers. If it's a poultry product, you know, how nutritious is that? So basically kibble, the kibble industry is a dumping ground for industry waste. So things that they can't say, even animals that are not processed for human food, they put rendered animals in that all the time. I mean, animals that die on the feedlot that are too sick, and they're, you know, they're the meat, the organ stuff is too damaged or diseased to use for human food. They just render it into dry food. They put euthanized animals in kibble diets. I mean, they have tested, they have found. So the euthanasia solution we use is in veterinarians is an overdose of pentobarbital. They've tested pentobarbital levels out of kibble diets. So they will grind up. So when you see something like animal meal, it can be literally anything. And you probably, you know, don't want to know.
No.
You don't want to know.
I mean, it sounds awful.
Yeah.
Oh, and imagine if all these millions of pets eating this, it's a miracle that they stay healthy. But
yeah, I'm surprised it doesn't kill them exactly. Much younger. Yeah. It's they're horrific. And, you know, the other thing to remember is any company that you see advertised on TV, because that's expensive advertising, they are owned by these big giant private equity companies. The Mars company, like Mars that makes candy bars, they own a large percentage of veterinary medicine. So they own like Blue Pearl, VCA, Banfield, these big corporate clinics that you see. Mars owns all of those. And they own a couple of the food companies. I think they own Royal Canin and maybe Waltham. Purina is owned by Nestle. I don't know how the candy companies get so big. But anyway, the point being that there's huge corporate conglomerates that own these companies. Your small pet food companies like the Raw pet food companies that I recommend typically to clients, they don't have the money to be advertising on TV. These companies that are putting these ads out, they're paying millions of dollars to learn how to market to people effectively, and they're putting the money into the advertising, not into the food. I can guarantee it. So they're putting out an inferior food and a very high marketing budget, but then they got such a wide audience, and then it shows up on the Today Show or Good Morning America or something. Well, it must be good because it showed up there, right? And they use all this really creative marketing. When you see that, I don't buy those products. I've said that for years. Don't buy anything you see advertised on TV because they're spending their money on marketing. And these private equity companies, do you think they're interested in pet health? They're tapping in to the pet industry because it's a multi-billion dollar, I mean, probably trillion dollar business by now. Tens of billions of dollars are spent every year in pet care. And these are profit-driven companies. They're just looking to tap in. They know that people will spend money on their pets. They know how much people love their pets. And they're tapping into that industry. And they are really, they're deceiving people. And on the veterinary side, I hear just horror stories of emergency room visits where, I mean, you step in the door, you're paying $5,000 to $10,000. And you're just, I actually had a friend, a good friend of mine who has been a vet tech. She's not currently working as a vet tech, but she has technician training. And she had a kitty that had a urinary blockage and went in. And they told her right off the bat, the quote was, I think $5,500, or you just have to euthanize. That's it. But she knew better. So she said, I want to see the estimate. And she knew what things she could take off. She said, I just want you to unblock my cat. I'll take my cat home and take care of it. Mm-hmm. But how many people can't do that? I mean, I shudder to think at how many, I bet you thousands of pets on a weekly, maybe daily basis are euthanized. Because how many people can afford an unexpected $5,000 or $10,000, you know, vet bill?
That's horrible.
And a lot of people can't, and they don't need to be charging that much. These procedures they're charging this much for, they could charge a fraction of what they're charging and still have a nice profitable business. You know, I'm a business owner too. Understand, we need to, you know, make a living, but they can do it without reaming people and without, you know, having people, you know, face these choices of, well, if you can't come up with the money, then, you know, we're just going to kill your pet. They don't give any intermediate options, which is what they should be doing.
You know, I'm curious, the veterinarian, our partners in veterinary medicine had a great deal going. They weren't in insurance plans like the allopathic doctors who were stuck taking fraction of what their value was for their service. How on earth did private equity get their hooks in them, since I thought it was basically fee for service?
Yeah, it used to be, and then it was honest, you know, because you were competing with the guy down the road. If you weren't treating people fairly, then they'd go, you know, to the vet down the road. They started buying up the clinics. Like I said, they saw the money, they saw the profitability, and they started just buying up clinics. And they offer vets a good amount of money for them. And I talk to clients and they say, yeah, I was going to a vet, like you said, maybe a conventional vet, but I really liked them. I felt like they were honest with me. I felt like they gave me good service. They said, and then they sold out to this corporation and the clinic's not the same now, you know, because it's just run by the corporation and it's all about money. And the vets, I think, get sucked into this system and they have a real hard time getting out of it. I'm sure that all vet students start out in veterinary school wanting to really take care of the animals. That's why they go into it. I mean, you don't go into veterinary medicine because you want to be wealthy. Not that you can't make a good living, but right, there's other professions you could make a whole lot more money for the time and energy you put into your education. They do it because they really want to help the animals. But because the private equity has taken over so much of the profession, the vet students are getting out of school, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. So they need the job, and the jobs typically pay well, they get benefits, you know, all those nice little perks. And then the vets are also paid on production. So they go in there and part of their salary is production, and they have quotas to make where they have to sell a certain amount, or they get docked, or they don't get their bonus, or there's some consequence to that. So they're under the gun then to sell these services. And I think the young vets just get wrapped up into that, and they haven't seen the other side of it. They don't understand. They just don't understand the difference. They don't see how wrong that is. You know, they just kind of get sucked into that system, and then it's very hard for them to find their way out. And that's one of my passions. I don't know the exact road to doing that, but to try to reach some of these young vets, even actually just today, I did a Zoom call with a veterinary student group at the University of Illinois. That's a group of veterinary students interested in holistic medicine. I thought if I can talk to some of these kids and let them know there's another way, you know, you don't have to work for these corporations. And I don't know if you've heard this statistic, but the suicide rate amongst veterinarians is one of the highest now of any profession. And I honestly believe, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I honestly believe that there's just a point where vets get into these corporate practices and they're selling their souls, and they feel it. But they feel trapped. They don't know what to do. They don't know. I mean, I didn't know how to be an entrepreneur. I became an entrepreneur because I wanted to practice the way I wanted to practice. And there were no jobs doing holistic medicine. There's probably more now, but not very many. And so what do? You got to start your own business. I didn't know how to run a business. You know, I had to figure that out through the life of hard knocks, but most vets don't want to do that. So what do? You know, most of veterinary medicine's owned by private equity, and they don't have the confidence to get out on their own. So they just end up feeling trapped. And I think feeling trapped is probably one of the worst places to be. And they got a lot of debt. And if they're starting a young family, you know, what do they do? You know, they don't have a lot of choices.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And it's paralleled in the medical system, you know, medical students. It's a seriously high suicide rate there too. And it's the same mindset of, I can't do it on my own, so I'm just going to go and get a job and work for somebody. But it's, as you say, it's soul crushing, and it works against the altruism, the empathy side of healthcare.
Yes.
The art of medicine. Not
yes.
everybody's the same. Not every pet is the same. You get to your answer by working with the family, working with the pet. That's the fun part of healthcare. In that system you just described, it's gone. It's yep. line them up, give them a shot, get them out, get the next one in. Yep. I have my own practice for the same reason, because I can't, conscience won't let me.
Yep. One size fits all, and it's becoming algorithmic. And I see this when I read, like, you know, I read records because I do a lot of, you know, second, third, fourth opinions in my practice now. And I read the records. I'm like, they're not even using their brains. And they only look at lab tests. I don't think you need to do any testing. If you're really paying attention to your patient, I'm not saying that testing doesn't have benefit, but say you did none, you did no blood work, no nothing. If you're really tuning into your patient, you could figure out a lot, and a good history and physical exam and what's going on. I mean, I can tell a lot, especially because I'm doing it a lot of years, without any diagnostic testing. But what I see with the current state of veterinary medicine is that's all they look at is the numbers on the blood work. I'm like, are they even looking at their patient? Like, I don't think they are. And they keep testing. Like, they don't have a clue how to treat until they can name a diagnosis based on some lab test. They can't even treat their patient. Look at your patient. It's got diarrhea. Maybe ate something wasn't supposed to, and the body's trying to detox. How about if we just support the GI tract and give it a couple days and let the body, you know, keep it hydrated and let the body figure it out, you know, instead of running up a, you know, doing $1,000 of tests right off the bat. You know, there's just no, there's no logic and no common sense in it. And I love what you said about, you know, it being an art. That's why my practice is animal healing arts, because I do believe that practicing medicine should be an art. And I think when that gets lost, then, I mean, how can you feel any sense of like purpose or fulfillment as a practitioner if you're not approaching it like an art and like a dance with your patient? I think it's impossible to feel that way.
I certainly wouldn't want to get up and do that every day. You know, that's, I can understand how people just feel like the whole color is stripped out of their life and their quality of life. Because we spend so many hours in the pursuit of knowledge and then applying it in our practice. And someone's standing in the way and telling you what you can't do, what you, you know, you can't work it up the way you want to. You can't treat the pet or the human the way you want to. And you know it's going to be a bad outcome. That's not a situation that any healer wants to be in. On that note, let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Jacek, and you know, I just love your style. I love where you're coming from. And if everybody practicing healthcare was of your mindset, I think we would not be in this situation at all. Now, at the beginning of the show, you talked about cancer and how it's kind of an explosion. And, you know, I've had a pet who passed away prematurely. He actually ate some Ryokane and food. I think it took him out, unfortunately. But how, what are the treatment options? I mean, chemo, radiation, and those things, surgery. But are there other natural modalities that people can actually start leaning on as a first line?
Oh yeah, and that's become my specialty because I've offered those things, and I don't recommend the traditional therapies at all. I don't recommend surgery unless the tumor is like, you know, causing a problem like urinary blockage or something like that, because I have found that using natural treatments that support the body, we can manage cancer without doing the attack the cancer approach. I don't even really like needle aspirates anymore to find out what it is. Again, it's like, I don't need that cancer named, that tumor named, to start to help my patient. Now, most of the people I work with, they come in with a diagnosis already because that's already been done. But I've seen many tumors blow up. I mean, just sometimes double or triple in size after just a simple needle aspirate. So what I look at is, okay, we've got this thing showed up. It's a tumor. As long as the patient's stable. Now, you can have emergencies where there's some types of tumors on the spleen or liver, hemangiosarcomas, that can bleed. So you can have a life-threatening bleed. Of course, that's emergency surgery. You need to do what you need to do. So once the pet is stable, to me, that tumor that showed up, or the lymphoma or whatever is presenting to us, this is the body telling us something. You know, I think we need to get away from or change the way we look at symptoms as like something's wrong, to what is the body trying to tell us? This is a sign. And when that tumor shows up, it's the tip of the iceberg. It's a sign of a long period of time of imbalance and toxicity. You know, usually it's nutritional imbalances or, you know, inadequacies and toxicity, including emotional toxicity, which I think does affect pets too. So my first approach is we start to build a healthy foundation. It doesn't matter to me what the type of cancer is, or where it's located. We start, the very first thing we do is, I have a nutritionist on my team, and every new patient that comes in meets with her. And people have to be willing to do the nutrition piece. If they did nothing else, they have to do that, because I'm not going to be able to help, do much to help the pets if they're not doing that nutrition piece. And then we get into other modalities. So I do, I work with Chinese herbal medicine. I love Chinese herbal medicine. because of its balancing effects on the body. Chinese herbal blends are designed to correct imbalances. So we see, where is that tumor showing up? Where is that issue showing up? That's the area of the body that is the most out of balance. So let's balance that part of the body and correct it. And there's some Chinese herbal blends that can have direct effects on tumors. In Chinese medicine, a tumor is an energy block. It's we need to move the qi, that there's an energy block in that part of the body. So we want to get the qi moving in that area. And then I've also moved into doing other therapies. One of the reasons I started working with a lot of cancer patients was because I found ozone therapy. Actually, I started doing ozone therapy because I had a client come to me that wanted to use ozone on her dog that had been diagnosed. It had actually had a tumor, a sarcoma removed from its leg. And she was told the dog had 6 months to live and they wanted to do chemo. And she said, I don't want to do chemo. I want to do ozone. Will you do it? And I had heard about it. I didn't know anything about it at the time. She said, I'll buy the equipment. And if you'll learn how to start treating my dog, I really want to do this. And she happened to know a human practitioner that was using ozone on people. And she'd already talked to this person and arranged for me to go shadow and say, I already know somebody you can go learn from and I'll bring the equipment in. Will you treat my dog with ozone? Like, okay, clearly the universe wants me to do this because it ended up falling in my lap. So I treated this dog and she ended up living 5 years. She died at 15 from something unrelated to the cancer. I think it was heart. I think it was her heart ultimately, but the cancer never came back. And then in that time, I had gotten additional training in ozone. And ozone's basically a way of oxygenating, providing extra oxygen for the body. Disease of any kind is going to progress more in the body if the healthy tissue is not properly oxygenated, because that supports the mitochondria, the energy production in the cells. So that's very briefly what ozone does. So, and there's ways people can buy ozone generators and do simple rectal ozone at home, which is you put a catheter up your pet's bum and you push your ozone gas in there and it's absorbed into the circulation through the colon, like any kind of suppository would be. And then in clinic, I would do IV treatments or we draw blood, mix the blood with the ozone, and then re-inject the ozonated blood. So there's therapies like that. Another thing I've gotten into probably in the past 8 or 9 years is mistletoe therapy. And this is something that's been used in Europe. It was actually developed by Rudolf Steiner. The therapeutic use of it for cancer patients was developed by Rudolf Steiner and Dr. Wegman back in the 1920s as part of anthroposophic medicine. It's used extensively in Germany. Something like 70% of human cancer patients in Germany get mistletoe therapy. And so this is basically a formulation of the mistletoe plant that grows in the trees, same thing that we use for the holiday decoration and all of that. There's certain varieties that are used and it's prepared in very special ways and made into a sterile form. And it's injected subcutaneously, so just underneath the skin, 3 times a week. And it has both an immunomodulating effect, meaning that it helps support the immune system. It helps to reduce overactivity. So if we have inflammation, or it can even help with autoimmune type diseases, helps moderate the immune system if it's overactive, and then it helps kind of activate it if the immune system is suppressed. And it also has anti-cancer effects. There's components in it that seem to go after cancer cells. You can inject it right around the tumor as well if you have an external tumor that you can access, and it can help to shrink tumors. So those are kind of the primary modalities I use. I actually prefer not to work with patients that are doing chemotherapy at the same time, because it makes it very hard to monitor what's causing what. If a pet's having adverse effects of a chemotherapy treatment, it's usually the mistletoe and the raw food that get blamed. It's never the chemo. So kind of got tired of you know, that battle. So now I just tell people, if you want to do that, it's fine. I respect your choice. You know, if you want me to support your pet when you're done with those protocols, but I'll do it. But I don't usually like to do it at the same time. So, you know, there's a lot that people can do. Now, do we always stop cancer? Do we always make tumors go away? No. And oftentimes, a lot of times we don't, but my goal is not that we have to make the cancer go away or the tumor go away, but can I make it something that the pet can live with and maintain quality of life? And I do feel like we achieve that in a lot of cases. And at the very least, we'll go much longer than conventional prediction. So a lot of, you know, people will come to me and say, I'm told, you know, my pet's going to be dead in 3 to 6 months and they don't want to do chemo. They don't want to do the conventional route. And, you know, 18 to 24 months later, we're still talking, you know, and the pet's still alive. Doesn't always happen that way. Kind of depends on, you know, again, when cancer shows up, we're behind the ball somewhere. Something's been affecting that body for a while. That doesn't just show up out of nowhere. And so depending on what the history is, unfortunately, a lot of rescue pets that come out of the rescue organizations are heavily, heavily vaccinated. And if they've been on poor diets, then we're starting, again, pretty far behind the ball. But we do the best we can. I believe there's always hope. And I focus on creating the best quality of life for the pet for as long as we can. And people that want that approach, those are the people that will enjoy working with me. If you've got the, I just got to go in there and nuke the cancer approach, then you won't work well with me.
And I respect that. That's a noble cause. You mentioned briefly that a toxic environment from a home environment standpoint, how do you ever have to get involved in terms of human toxicity affecting the cat or dog?
Yeah. You mean like emotions and energy? Yeah. I mean, that's a really tricky one because I recognize it. It's almost to where I can tell when I first start working with a new patient, I can tell based on the personality of the human involved if they're going to do well or not. But it's a real hard thing to address, you know, like how do I say that, you know, to the human? So, you know, I do say things to people like, you know, as much as you can try to stay out of fear and think positively, because if the whole energetics of the condition of the pet is surrounded by fear, fear is extremely toxic and it's a very toxic emotion. And, you know, they tend to not do as well because the pets, they're not sitting around being worried about that they got cancer. They couldn't care less. I mean, they just want to eat and play and go for walks and do their pet stuff. They're not sitting around worried about it, but they're going to take on that energy from the people around them. And of course it's natural to be concerned when your pet's sick. But it's also important to remember that the body can heal and to try to put things in a positive light as much as you can. I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, all sorts of things. We all have our lives and we, you know, stuff goes on at home and there's stressors and people have to move or there's deaths in the family. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff happens. And I do think it affects the pets. I think dogs especially take on their human energy to a tremendous degree. So as much as people can remember that and try to normalize their pet's life as much as they can, meaning getting them out to do things that they enjoy and go for walks and play ball or whatever it is that they like, I do think that's important. And you know what? Getting outside in the sunshine is good for people too. So I feel like if they do that for their dog, then it's probably going to help them as well.
I would agree. And, you know, time goes way too fast, but I want to make sure that people know how to go to your website. It's ahavet.com. And do you offer other things like for education purposes and other services?
Well, there's a lot. We have a lot on our website. I've got blog articles. I also have a Substack. It's judyjasekdvm.substack.com. And that's on our website as well. So any like new articles and stuff, I try to get something out there once or twice a week. Been a little lax lately, but that's where I've got, you know, more recent education. And right now you have to subscribe, but there's no fee or anything for that. So it's quite a bit of education on our website. There's a whole list of past podcasts and things like that I've done. So there's a lot of good information there. And I do, we do wellness consults. People can come in and just do a nutrition consult. We have a nutritionist on our team. And if you just want to come in and just talk about the diet piece, which is the most important piece anyway, you can certainly do that. And then, you know, we do wellness consults where we can just talk about, you know, vaccines. And then there's the heartworm and flea and tick and all these other preventatives that are often recommended that are also very toxic. So I can, you know, we can help you with that sort of thing as well. Pet doesn't have to be sick. I love doing like puppy consults because we can get them off on the right paw, so to speak, so that I don't see them back when they're, you know, 8 years old with cancer.
Now, if you're not in the state, can you still do telemedicine consults like for wellness?
Yep, I do. Mm-hmm. I don't prescribe anything, you know, I don't do any kind of prescriptions, but you know, we can talk about wellness. I can certainly still do the consult.
Oh, that's good to know. Well, you know, I feel blessed to have met you and to have this conversation because it's so nice to have like-minded people, whether we're vets or medical doctors, whoever, who are thinkers, who are critical thinkers and just want to do the right thing for the right reason. I love that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to get the word out to people in different audiences, because it's like you said before, until people know what's going on and understand it, they can't take action. And by the time they're at the vet or in the ER with the sick pet and they're panicked and they're emotional and they're scared because their pet's sick and they don't know what to do, you know, they need to be armed with the information before that. And so I just really appreciate the opportunity to, you know, get on my soapbox for a bit and get the word out.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you on the soapbox. I appreciate you. So once again, thank you so much for joining me. I look forward to having you back on in the future.
Awesome. I'd love to.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk Events.